something that Julie and I can talk about all day long.
Oh, yeah.
Many families who lose loved ones display an array of emotions that grief brings on. Sometimes the family members feel anger or distrust with God or frustration with the unwanted circumstances before them.
Rabbi Weiner explains that his role is to help ground these families in these moments of grief. He offers his compassion and love and tries to help soothe the tension experienced after a loss of a loved one.
So we're collectively experiencing grief across the globe right now, and many are not able to fully go through the process of grief as COVID-19 continues to produce more grief before we can heal from prior losses. Faith leaders and representatives have been challenged to discover ways in which they can still offer spiritual support under new restrictions that the pandemic has brought.
Many have adapted to institute new facets of supportive systems within faith-based communities. The underlying message is that no one is in this alone. Faith leaders want to remind people that their emotions are valid and there is space to work through their grief process and begin to heal, even if the space is virtual for the time being.
Indeed. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KABU. Consider adding KABU to your will, or add KABU as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KABU along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KABU to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032. Or email development@kabu.fm to notify us of your plans.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good evening and welcome to Trans Positive PDX on here on KBOO FM. Tonight, our show, we continue our theme of trans sex, love, and dating. I am Jean Bryant. I use she and her pronouns. I'll be your host tonight, and co-hosting with me is.
My name is Emma Lugo, and I also use she and her pronouns.
All right. With that, our special guest this evening is Lucy Fielding. Lucy is the author of the upcoming book titled Trans Sex, Clinical Approaches to Trans Sexualities and Erotic Embodiments. Now, it's scheduled to be released May 24th. And it's published by Routledge. And I think that that's important because Routledge is well-known, the world's leading publisher of academic books, journals, and online references in the humanities and social sciences. I think that speaks a lot to the credibility of Lucy's work. And Lucy is a resident in counseling, practicing in Charlottesville, Virginia. She received her master's in counseling psychology at Pacifica Graduate Institute. And Lucy also holds a PhD in French from Northwestern University, where she specialized in 18th century literature, histories of sexuality, and erotic literature. her background in literature and history attunes her to the many ways that image, metaphor, and cultural scripts shape and inform the narratives we carry with us as we move through the world, as well as how these narratives inscribe themselves on our bodies. And you can find out more about Lucy at lucyfielding.com. And we will repeat that at least another time before we end the show. Now, Lucy's book has received multiple high-powered professional endorsements, but I wanted to read this one by Susan Stryker. Susan's of my generation and someone that I respect tremendously. And Susan says, too much of the literature on gender transness falls off the balance beam, either ignoring transsexuality or sexually objectifying trans people. Lucy Fielding's trans sex hits a sweet spot. It offers psychotherapists, medical care providers, sex educators, and other professionals a compassionate and deeply grounded guide to working with trans folks and our sexualities. It is simultaneously learned and approachable, practical and theoretical, permission granting and boundary setting, and encourages the kind of respectful and ethical curiosity about our lives on which successful therapies depend. I think that's huge. And then I was able to read an advanced copy of Trans Sex, and I want to add my own endorsement here before we start. As a trans elder, I celebrate that an increasing number of queer and non-cis folks are entering the healthcare, research, and academic professions. Lucy Fielding embodies the coming of age of this next generation of practitioners. While her book necessarily calls out and deconstructs numerous aspects of dominant Western cultural paradigms, more importantly, in her book, she has called in and included refreshingly broad-based participation and voices and perspectives, and also brings forward the historic and innate wisdoms of our community's lived experience. She begins to construct a new paradigm that expands upon what's come to commonly be called trauma-informed care and gender-affirming care. This is the most expansive, holistic, nuanced, and innovative work on sexuality I've ever read. And note here, I didn't say transsexuality. In some ways, in fact, I think the title falls a little short. This is not another self-help book, nor is it Kama Sutra remake. It's targeted at professional practitioners, which I'm not, but it is so readable and so relatable. I wish I had had it 30 years ago. With that, my most gracious welcome to Lucy Fielding.
Oh, gosh. Thank you, Jean. That's lovely. And thank you to both you and to Emma for having me on the show. It's such a privilege.
Lucy, if you would please, by way of modeling, I think a really cool piece of your work, would you please, if you will, locate yourself for us in our audience?
Absolutely. So my name is Lucy Fielding, with an IE instead of a Y, just because I had to be particular about it. My pronouns are she and they. I experience a frisson, a glee, when they are interchanged with abandon. I am a white, queer, kinky, polyamorous, visibly able-bodied, Jewish, non-binary trans femme. And I am 43 years old as of January. So So I kind of chuckled at being seen as like the new generation, you know, because I feel like there are so many who I whose work is just amazing to me, and so like I'm really excited to feature some of those voices and to continue featuring them, and it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, you know, actually that's that brings up a point for me. I want to say that I think the bibliography and the footnotes of your work are some of the most impressive work that I, you know, that I've seen. And so I thought maybe you might talk a little bit about your other experience with your PhD in French and literature and history, because it seemed so obvious to me that your research is just so impressive.
Thank you. I think I was talking to a friend about this this morning, and with my work, I come at it as a humanist. You know, it's like I get so much joy from stories, from images, from reading and experiencing and touching history. And so, you know, even though like I can speak, for example, the language of neuroscience, and that's something I can read, it's not something that really grabs me. Like when somebody in talking about like a theory that's very much in vogue right now, and called polyvagal theory, and says, well, you know, it's like the ventral vagal things, you know, it's like, I don't know what that means. I don't know how that lives in my body. And whereas like, I do know how images lodge there, I can feel this visceral sense of, and this is what really brought the work to the fore, was I had the sense as I was engaging in a gender transition, a professional transition, because I'd been an academic and in academic administration for a while, and this is really my, you know, third career, and I was in the midst of seeing, you know, as both a client and a patient, all these providers, who most of whom are cis, and then I was also becoming trained as a sexuality professional and as a therapist.
Oh, excuse me. It dawns on me. Let's set that in context for our listeners, Lucy. You bridged to your shift to your current profession, and I think that there's a piece there that could expand on.
Sure. I think certainly, like reading erotic literature and studying histories of sexuality, you know, I could see the sweep of it. You know, like and so, like, I could read things that are written in the present day, or, you know, within the last 100 years, and see, like, oh, God, that has its basis in settler colonial ideology, and that has its basis in, you know, like, inversion theory of, you know, the 19th century. So like Havelock Ellis, and this was the one of the first kind of theories of both transness and homosexuality in the later term that would be used. And, you know, and just seeing like how it continues to play out, you know, because if, for example, inversion theory, and Freud talks about it in Three Essays on Sexuality in 1905, is based on this idea that that the attraction of men to other men, women to other women, is based on the idea that they have a body that is not congruent with their soul, with that and so that in some ways for those who are proposing it was suggesting, well, okay, so it's okay because it's still a heterosexual modeling, but it's just that the female soul is talking to the male soul. And so, you know, and it then, you know, becomes quickly like the born in the wrong body idea.
Yeah.
You know, that is so foundational to the birth of gender affirmative care in Europe and the United States, culminating in like Harry Benjamin's The Transsexual Phenomenon of 1966, and then all the gender clinics of the 70s and 80s, and all those the criteria, the gatekeeping criteria that were based, steeped in this history.
This is Emma. It's time for the KBOO Spring Pledge Drive. Did you know KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland? KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, people. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free thanks to the support we receive from our members. KBOO is a non-profit organization, and know when that is. 80% of our funding comes from our members. You can donate today by clicking Donate in the mobile app, texting KBOO to 44-321, or you can mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. The best way is to go to kboo.fm/give. Less than 10% of listeners are members of KBOO. So won't you consider donating today at kboo.fm/give? Thank you.
So, Lucy, in hearing you discuss the issue of inversion therapy and how ideas about what was normative heterosexualities was constructed at the beginning of the 20th century, it reminds me of the interview that I listened to with you recently. It was about a month ago. You were on some podcast. And there was something that you said in that podcast that was really revolutionary to me, and like really mind-opening. And you're kind of like opening the door, like you are right now, to this idea that there are like many ways of interpreting and understanding sexuality, gender identity, and pleasure. And that like part of what we need to do is, when we're addressing issues like, for instance, trans rights and transsexualities, if we are talking about differently abled people and their sexualities, if we're talking about elderly people and their sexualities, if we're talking about the many different ways in which people experience pleasure and joy, like it sounds like you're sort of opening the door to a whole new interpretation, a whole new kind of framework of how to understand sex and pleasure. Could you comment on that?
Sure. So I think what I'm trying to do in the book is that, you know, you just named a set of populations that are not really seen in sexological research, in sexuality education. I mean, there are, of course, community resources and texts. I mean, you know, just for trans and non-binary folks, I mean, Mira Bellwether's and the trans sex scene out of, I believe it's Minnesota, and there's a trans kink zine that's coming. There's a lot of incredible inclusivity in Allison Moon's Girl Sex 101. And then of course, you know, the rich landscape that was Tumblr before FOSTA and SESTA came into being, Instagram, parts of Reddit, now Discord, and you know, all these spaces that we have developed as a community to share knowledge. And I was really tired as a trainee of reading this like stuff written for primarily cis, het, white, young, thin, able-bodied bodies. And I really wanted to take a step at saying, you know, like, I don't want to extrapolate my experience anymore from cis experiencing. I'd like for cis folks to learn from us, because we have so much wisdom in our communities, so much that we have figured out. We are ingenious. I mean, who takes something that, you know, is involved in like a wellness exam, you know, where somebody, where a doctor, you know, may check for a hernia, and then suddenly it becomes like, oh wait, there's all these nerve endings here, and there's so much packed in here to enjoy, and we can use this to experience so much pleasure. And you know, that may be great for, I mean, that was a revelation for me. And as somebody who works with cis and trans clients alike, I want to take that knowledge to cis folks, because, you know, I think one of the things that we know under that is that cis folks are harmed by transphobia and trans misogyny in ways that that are different but are just as toxic, because it keeps cis folks in this belief that they have to have sex in a very particular way, and so you get things like, you know, genitals being connected with gender, and genitals being used in very particular ways. And I just wanted to throw out the scripts and come at things from a beginner's mind and from this place of curiosity and wonder. And I don't know what this is, but I really want to just sit.
I think, you know, you've shared a lot of what, you know, moved you to write the book, and where you're coming from in it. Let's talk about some of the, you know, the specific structure of the book, which I think is also pretty fascinating, or it was to me, how you've packaged this and how you've constructed it. So give us just kind of a quick, you know, overview of what's in the book.
So it's six chapters in total, plus an introduction and a glossary. Chapter one is where I basically am putting under a microscope some of the dominant narratives that that are in the kind of the clinical literature and also the popular imagination around trans and non-binary folks and our erotic lives.
Yeah, I kind of, in my own mind, I kind of saw this as where you lay out the playing field.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That. Yeah. You know, and just like this is what we are in some ways up against. This is what is in the room with us, and not just when we're sitting across from a provider, or when we are a provider, you know, how that is influencing how we are engaging with our clients and patients. But really, like, what we are bringing to the room with us, you know, there's that fabulous documentary Disclosure, and Jen Richards, the actress, has this wonderful quote about, like, I'm paraphrasing, but like, trans folks, we carry within us the histories of our representation. Yeah. You know, and I know for myself, like, I mean, my cinematic diet, you know, came from, like, I grew up and kind of came of age initially sexually within you know, the 1990s, and so seeing films like The Crying Game and seeing, like, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, and these, and I mean, honestly, like, it, those films like that, representations like that, probably held me back for the longest time. For at least 10 years, from really giving myself permission to deepen into gender and into the fact that my body could be a magically multi-orgasmic, polymorphously perverse playground of wonder that I now think of it as. But that's what the stakes are of chapter one. So I talk about things like how, and I imagine we will probably get into this a little bit, but a discourse of desirability, and erotic privilege. I talk about kind of the discourses of trade-off, and loss that we are so often faced with, this idea that, like, we're given this choice between you can experience a sex life that is familiar to you, or you can resolve gender dysphoria. Those are your choices. So either be miserable, you know, from you know, and experience gender dysphoria, or resolve it, but, like, your sex life is going to be less than. And we see that in so many of the ways that providers describe what certain transition pathways lead to, and even assume that, like, we all want to have access to all of those transition pathways, or that we even want any of those transition pathways. So I've made certain choices in my life based on access, based on desire, and other people are going to make very different ones, and that's okay. And it's just that I don't want possibilities to be foreclosed from the outset because providers aren't giving clients and patients the kind of nuanced guidance and support that we can and that we should. After chapter one, I move into.
Oh, okay. Excuse me. Before we leave chapter one, cool. you get into a piece about what constitutes informed consent. Mm-hmm. And then also as part of that, and I'm paraphrasing here, you do recognize the paradoxical nature of a pathologized diagnosis, okay? Which mm-hmm. then opens the doorways for, at least in the United States, mm-hmm. In terms of insurance coverages, and actual access to care, and how contradictory and paradoxical that is, not just for the individual, but for us as a community and for you as a provider.
Yeah, it feels very weird sometimes to be participating in a system and using, like when I'm writing letters of support, for folks to access various treatments or to access kind of name changes or gender marker changes on legal documents. It's that I have to use language that the insurance company wants to hear. And at the same time, I'm thinking, oh God, I just feel kind of icky as I'm doing that. I follow an informed consent model of care, to say, like, really my standard is one of thoughtfulness. Have you considered things? Have we engaged in a discussion of the risks and benefits of various, steps that you might want to take? And and then there's often a conversation with the clients as I'm writing the letter, and I always describe this is what the letter looks like. So and here's why I wrote this up in certain ways. But it's still some of the old models of letter writing, still contain, this kind of stuff of success that was, taken out of the current WPATH standards of care, success living in your target gender.
Yeah, your binary, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Even though that's taken out of the standards of care, we're still talking a lot of the times about it because we have to say, the client did this, and then they did this, and then they did this, and this is how it was. This is how it resolved gender dysphoria for them. And then you make the case of why there's a medical necessity for whatever, or legal necessity for whatever the subject of the letter is. And it's something like it's a pleasure and an honor to write those letters and occupying that position of being
trans and a letter writer participating in that system.
Although, you know, an expansive, informed, you know, practice, as you describe it for your own practice, you know, that's great, but, you know, really informed practitioners are actually kind of few and far between, unfortunately. And so many folks are faced, you know, of our community are faced with dealing still to this day with providers that aren't quite so woke as what you know describe. So, you know, we're stuck with that, unfortunately. We're breaking it down progressively, but we are still stuck with it. And both as providers and as clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's also a system where I think a lot of clients and patients don't feel empowered, especially with like medical professionals, feel really empowered to, you know, call in their providers. Mm-hmm. And not just
in the counseling arena.
Yeah.
All aspects of our healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to gear this book towards providers, because I really wanted this first book. I'm hoping that book two will be entirely community facing, and I'm really excited for that. But book one, I really wanted to really call providers' attention to the nuance and really stop them from relying on the sense, and you see it all over the, you know, like most sex education texts of the last 5-10 years will contain an apology in the introduction that says like, I would love to be talking about trans folks, but the research base isn't there. And so I'm primarily talking about cis folks. And we may think that we can apply this information to trans folks, but we can't. And so I'm not going to make that leap. And that gives providers an out to not an example of this is, and this is where like sometimes I get on my soapbox, but like an example of this is when we pursue hormone therapies, HT, and we are told by providers, well, if you take T, your libido is going to go up. If you take estrogen and spironolactone, progesterone, your libido is going to drop. And it's sometimes described as like a precipitous drop.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, it's what I was talking about these trade-offs. Like, oh, great. Like if I'm hearing this as a patient, you know, my endocrinologist is doing their due diligence and saying, you know, this is a possible side effect of this this medication. You know, what does that put in my head? This idea that like, well, okay, well, I guess I'm just not going to you know, have much of a sex life now or in a relationship to the erotic. And, you know, and instead I want to challenge folks to reach for the nuance. So like, you know, and this is not, you know, really new research, but the stuff on, you know, different desire templates, responsive desire and spontaneous desire, really popularized by Emily Nagoski in Come As You Are, is, you know, like, why aren't we applying that so that we're no longer talking about a loss or something that, you know, that is a trade-off, and that we are instead saying, you know, there's variation. And by the way, our desire is keyed to context, our arousal is keyed to context. And as we feel yummy in our bodies, as we feel, you know, like hormones coursing through our bodies, as we, you know, have top surgery or feel affirmed in our gender, or we're with partners who see us and can delight in our bodies, you know, then that's a really great context. I mean, we call this gender euphoria, what I'm talking about. There's a person on Instagram who's a leather maker in just outside of Portland, River Queer Leatherwork, and they have a term that they talk about in their stories called gender good. And I actually like that a ton better than gender euphoria, because one, it sounds less clinical, and two, it feels more approachable. Like, you know, like I know what gender good feels.
Yeah. I heard you loud and clear there. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Attainable. You are listening to Transpositive PDX on KBOO FM of Portland, Oregon. And tonight we are speaking with Lucy Fielding, the author of the upcoming book, Trans Sex: Clinical Approaches to Transsexualities and Erotic Embodiments. Before we had to take that break, we were talking about the contents of the book that you've written. And there are 6 chapters. We've only gotten through 1 chapter, and we still had more to say about it. There's a strong possibility that if you're willing and available, we will bridge this to yet a second show, because there's so much in what you've done here in your project that we could unpack.
I'm happy to. Let's keep talking.
Okay, great. So, you know, in chapter 1, you arguably, you know, describe the playing field. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
So, interestingly, when you get into chapter 2, this is speaking more to the practitioners out there, the professional community. But let's talk about that one.
So, chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5 are introducing a model for providers working at the intersection of gender and sexuality. And in many ways, those 4 chapters are an answer to each of the 4 dominant discourses that I unpack, deconstruct, and generally poo-poo in the first chapter. And so chapter 2 is, I introduce a concept called ethical curiosity. And what that comes out of is this idea that, like, I was actually, this comes out of, again, my counseling program. And I was you know, in this class on imaginal psychology, and the instructor, you know, started like, you know, extolling the virtues of curiosity, and you know, and that like curiosity is wonderful and fabulous, and you know, we have this desire to know. And while I'm a big fan of curiosity, and certainly I talk about it a lot in the rest of the book, I recognize that curiosity has often been weaponized against trans and non-binary folks, by family members, by popular culture and media figures, and by their providers. And so I wanted to kind of lay out what the kind of the cis gaze is and what it can feel like. I start out that chapter with describing a moment where I was coming out to a supervisor and proceeded to get sexually harassed. And I wanted to take the reader with me with that, so that they are feeling it viscerally. This is what it feels like when somebody is just like, the questions may start out innocent and okay, and then somewhere along the line they just, things turn, and suddenly being asked about like what my genitals look like and whether I'm going to engage in the surgery and how my partners and I have sex. And I just like, and we're so used to this gaze, this curiosity that is denuding, that is objectifying, that is fetishizing, that is chasing. And I just, so I wanted to give providers not just an idea of what not to do, but here are some tools of what you can do. Here's some ways that you can alter your practice so that you are asking questions and engaging clients in a way that does not show that you have this sense of entitlement over knowing things about your clients and patients. You know, that sense of entitlement can often come up in very unconscious ways, and where the provider is just really doing like the insurance company's bidding or the standards of care's bidding, but like, so they're doing things for a reason, but this objectifying curiosity that demands performance by trans and non-binary folks to access care is kind of embedded in that, and we get taken in through that. And that's kind of what I was talking about with like letter writing.
And that, you know, even though I think at this point anybody who's operating as a practitioner in this field at all must at this point have, you know, ongoing training in trauma-informed, what's called trauma-informed, you know,
yes,
care and stuff. Nonetheless, this script continues, it's been perpetuated. It continues to be perpetuated. Yeah.
This is Emma. It's time for the KBOO Spring Pledge Drive. Did you know KBOO is 52 years old and one of the oldest community radio stations in the country and one of the oldest media institutions in Portland? KBOO programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, people. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. KBOO has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free thanks to the support we receive from our members. KBOO is a non-profit organization and know when that is. 80% of our funding comes from our members. You can donate today by clicking Donate in the mobile app, texting KBOO to 44-321, or you can mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. The best way is to go to kboo.fm/give. Less than 10% of listeners are members of KBOO. So won't you consider donating today at kboo.fm/give? Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to, you know, like, suggest... I mean, really, I don't think that there's anything in Chapter 2 that is particularly, to my mind, groundbreaking or novel. In the sense that, like, I think that if we look at, like, as providers, our ethical codes, some of this stuff is already written there. And some providers are doing pieces of this. And I just really wanted to bring it all together. And, you know, so for example, like the notion of informed consent, a lot of providers will do it at the beginning of a session, like at an intake session, or at the beginning of a you know, particular elected treatment pathway. But then, like, we don't continue to ask permission, to seek permission, to check in with our clients and patients. And so I really wanted to give providers, like, here's how you can do that. You know, like, it's important when, like, you just don't assume that consent is, that the informed consent that you gathered in the first session is blanket across the, all of your work with somebody. You know, like, I always assume, even if, like, there's kind of like, if I'm working with a client and say we're doing trauma processing, we may do that, some really deep work, some really intense work in the first, in one session. And the next session, they might come back and be like, Lucy, I am just not feeling it today. And so, like, I really want to hear that and respect that. And I want to provide a forum where clients feel empowered to say that. And so, like, I ask, you know, like, well, we were going to talk about this and continue on from last time. Is that still something that you want to talk about? Or I might check in and say, cool. Very quickly, three is really laying out how can providers start to engage trans and non-binary clients and patients in ways that, instead of foreclosing conversation, shutting down horizons of possibility, that we open things up, that we engage, you know, passion is one of kind of two relational energies. You know, it's passion is what often typifies the beginning of a relationship. It's, you know, it's exciting, it's fantasy, it's not knowing, it's where all of the really juicy, erotic, NRE, you know, stuff is, new relationship energy. And then, you know, and intimacy is often another energy. So that is one of, you know, closeness and safety and connection, and not knocking that. But often the problem with intimacy as a relational energy. And we see this often with respect to, you know, like our interpersonal relationships, that as we become intimate with partners, say, we start tricking ourselves into believing that we know all there is to know about our partners. And that's just not true. There's so many things to know, to explore, to experience. And so I really wanted to internalize that dynamic. So coming into passionate relationship is about saying, how do we mystify our relationship to ourselves, to our bodies? How do we say, like, I don't know what this is. I'm going to approach myself anew, and thereby my partners anew. And so I can discover a new landscape of pleasure in my body. And we're all in it right now. Even before COVID, you know, it's like we as community experience a great deal of minority stress, or insidious trauma is another word for that. And then we may experience event-based traumas, we may experience developmental traumas, and we often will, and we're in the midst of one right now, a collective trauma. That's what the pandemic is, a collective trauma. Yeah. We can also experience intergenerational trauma. So like if we all carry within our bodies and within our lineage that trauma. So, you know, the trauma of diaspora, the trauma of settlement and displacement and genocide and the erasure of indigenous traditions. We carry that with us. We carry serfdom. We carry the transatlantic slave trade. And so that is with us and present to us. And so part of what I want to recognize is that, you know, we may come in saying like, God, I really want to experience pleasure and eroticism in my body, but it's kind of scary. It's really scary for me, and it feels really risky. And so that's what chapter four is about, is to really say, how can we as providers create a container, an environment that feels bounded, that allows for, and I take this from like the kink community, you know, and from an experience of like, what is a scene? A scene is what I call in the book bounded chaos. You know, there's the yummy stuff that happens within a scene, the surprising things, the altered states, the gleefulness. And then there is mixed in with that that none of that is possible unless there is the frame, the boundedness of feeling like, okay, well, we've negotiated this. Yeah. There's trust between us. There's a framework in place. Yeah. There's safe words, or we're using the stoplight system. Yeah.
Before we go, Lucy, you know, and I say thank you so much for your time today. I want to be sure for you to be able to let people know how they can find out more about you and about your book. So please.
Well, I'm on Instagram as Lucy Fielding, at Lucy Fielding, L-U-C-I-E, Fielding. And lucyfielding.com is my website. And, you know, it's possible to pre-order.
Yeah. Okay. Well, once again, thank you so much for your time today. We've been talking with Lucy Fielding, the author of Trans Sex. And this has been Trans Positive PDX on KBOO. We will see you again with the second edition, I guess, the continuation of this conversation. So with that, I'm Jean Bryant. Good evening. Thank you for joining us. And Emma?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. It's been so great having you on. And Lucy, if it's good with you, we'll have you back in like 2 weeks for another show. That'd be great.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.